Welcome to Webinar Wednesdays. My name is Aaron Lurie. I am the Director of Professional Learning here at NAESP. And today is Wednesday, December the 12th, 2018. Today we have two dynamic speakers with us today, a dynamic duo. We have Dr. William Parrott and Dr. Kathleen Budge. How are you, Dr. William Parrott and Dr. Kathleen Budge?
We're great.
We are doing great.
Today's topic is Disrupting Poverty, 5 Powerful Classroom Practices. Let me tell you a little bit about our speakers before we begin. Our speakers for today are Dr. William Parrott and Dr. Kathleen Budge. Dr. William Parrott is the director of the Boise State University Center of School Improvement and Policy Studies. Dr. Kathleen Budge is the director of department chair, and associate professor of the Leadership Development Program at Boise State University. This duo has several best-selling books, and their newest book is called Disrupting Poverty, 5 Powerful Classroom Practices. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourselves?
We'd be happy to. We're in Boise, Idaho right now, and it's where it's sunny and about 30 degrees. We've been here for quite a while at the university and spent a lot of time all over the country studying teachers and schools in circumstances of significant poverty, particularly looking for practices and aspects of those schools that make a lot of sense that we can share with others.
We focused on leadership, which is a part of what we're going to talk to you about today in those studies, and we'll talk more about this in a bit, but we'll be drawing on 3 primary pieces of material for the webinar this afternoon.
Well, Dr. Parrott, can you share, since you all have co-authored several books, can you share some other books with our audience, just in case we want to get those books?
Sure we can. The latest, as you mentioned, these are ASCD books and products, and we're going to draw a lot, as Kathleen mentioned, from 3 fairly recent works. One is the Disrupting Poverty you mentioned that came out last January. And then a couple of years before that, we did a video series on high-performing, high-poverty elementary schools through ASCD. And there'll be a slide in the slide deck where you can see more information on that. That was a chance for us to spend time in those schools across the country in 5 different states. The work primarily originated from our study of high-performing, high-poverty schools from about 5 years back, and that was entitled Turning High-Poverty Schools into High-Performing Schools, another ASCD book that's still out there. So that's basically what we're going to talk about and talk from today.
Okay, great. Now, everyone's coming muted, and we have a Q&A box today, so if you have any questions for Kathleen or William, you'll just put your questions in the question box and we'll answer them at the end. Thanks for being here, Dr. Parrott and Dr. Budge, and I'll turn it over to you at this time.
Okay, thank you, Aaron, an honor, and thanks to NAESP. Great organization. We love being with you today. As we looked at the folks that have joined us, we understand there are about and a few more registered today. We've got around 180 people representing, as of yesterday, about 44 states and Washington, D.C. and the Virgin Islands. Folks are online right now from Alaska to Maine to, again, Hawaii, Florida, Arizona, and right here in Boise, Idaho. They could have driven up and sat in with us today, but nonetheless, our colleague Rob Winslow is listening in. It was interesting looking through the roster, places like Parachute, Colorado, we've not spent any time in, actually hadn't heard of. So we welcome any and all of you from wherever you are, and we know a lot of you are stepping out of your leadership roles right now to sit in this webinar, and we hope it'll be of benefit to you.
So a little bit about how we've put the webinar together, and for today, what we have done is, we have put together a webinar that what we hope you'll be able to do is take this and use it with faculty. And that'll become clearer as we move forward. Our outcomes for you, two learner outcomes, is we hope that you emerge with enhanced understanding of how to disrupt the adverse influence of poverty on learning, and that you're better prepared to take informed action in meeting the needs of students who underachieve and live in poverty.
We're going to go really quickly today, and again, you've got the slide deck, so any questions you have, you could list under the questions in the box, or you feel free to email us after this is over. We're happy to talk with anybody that way. We're going to validate a lot of what you do today. We know all of you, by virtue of signing up and being on this webinar, care deeply about your kids that live in poverty and underachieve, and probably are having success with a number of those kids, but maybe aren't where you want to be. So we're going to validate a lot of what you hear today are things that you're doing. We'll talk about how you might tweak and improve on those actions as a part of the lower part of this mirror, which is we're going to challenge you to improve. We'd like you to think of this mirror throughout the presentation, holding it up and looking at yourselves in terms of how are we doing versus what we're hearing that these schools and educators that have had considerable success do. These are the three resources that I mentioned a moment ago. The lower right is the recent book and what we'll spend most of the day on, The Five Powerful Classroom Practices of Disrupting Poverty. The upper book was the original study we did that focused on, again, studying high-performing, high-poverty schools across the country and gleaning from them what exactly they did, and the video series on disrupting poverty in the lower left there. So those will be what you'll hear a lot from today. The original study enabled us to create a framework for action. This framework represents what we saw happening in these high-performing, high-poverty schools. And if I can draw your attention quickly to the larger gear in the upper right, those three aspects of practice and disposition and behavior conditions in these schools represent, and I'll mention them quickly, they all fostered healthy, safe, and supportive learning environments. They all focused on learning, student learning, obviously, but professional learning in particular, they spent a great deal of time on. And the systems all got more efficient, smarter, better operating to serve these kids. And the third action area, building leadership capacity, was one that obviously involves the hiring, the budgets, and all of that part of schools, but it also involves engaging all of the adults, kind of getting everybody on board in the way of adult support in schools to realize what aspect of their role involved leadership and drawing that from them. Those actions drove changes and improvements, dramatic at times, in school culture, which is the lower gear. And as you look around that, I'll just mention them quickly. High expectations and support, commitment to equity, professional accountability for learning, courage and will to take action, caring relationships and advocacy. We know in all of your schools these things are going on. The difference that we found in the schools we studied that had truly reached high performance and sustained those gains with kids was the depth of which those practices became part of the school, of all the adults in the school. And we'll talk a lot more about these five areas. And under spheres of influence, obviously those are the various parts of the connective tissue that link you to your kids, your classrooms, your community, your family, your district. And those will be referenced throughout our presentation today as well.
So what we did for the book that we're going to talk to you about today is we went in and we interviewed teachers, and about 45 teachers in total, at least half of which were in high performing, high poverty schools, but half of which were just in schools. And those teachers were recommended to us as teachers who were master teachers, kid whisperer kinds of teachers. And about half of that group had themselves grown up in poverty. And the reason that we did that was to go in and actually ask them, We knew the five conditions that you see on that purple gear on your screen. We knew those were the conditions that had brought success to the schools that we'd studied. We knew that successful teachers were likely using those same values and making those the norms in their classroom, but we didn't know how. And so that is really what a lot of what today is about how. What was it that they attributed their success to? We're going to start today with a video, and we're going to hope that these we've practiced with these and there may be a slight lag. But what we'd like for you to do is just watch this video, and then we will use it to make an important point about one of our findings.
Morning! Good morning! Good morning! All right, good morning. So, you remember what I said I was bringing today? I said grace and clementines. You know what a clementine is? Good morning. Do you want a grape or do you want a clementine? Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Did you have a good night last night?
No.
What happened?
I needed my candy yesterday.
You need it? All right, Clayton sisters, have a great day today. Other than that, you had a good night last night, right? It's always awesome to see a dad walking a child to school. We only have two dads to walk. The rest of you, the moms, or they're by themselves.
I don't see myself as a central office administrator. I am a teacher. You know, great teaching. You're molding minds. You are leading learners to become successful. You're leading students down a path that sometimes they didn't realize they needed to be on.
Okay, you're like Ms. Stewart. Okay, so that's why you're going to go to school no matter what? That's great. Well, good. You're going to go. I'm going to tell Ms. Stewart you said that. I'm going to school no matter what.
I do a walkthrough in every school pretty much every day. So this morning I like to spend time in classrooms really looking at instruction, student engagement. The morning is great because I get a chance to see literacy in the early morning hours. Most people, you know, spend a lot of time focusing on communication arts in the AM. This week we're testing, and so much of my time is spent in the primary classes in particular. In the morning, because the morning time is testing here.
In the past, a lot of us may have been ashamed to say that our children were in the Jennings School District. It was unaccredited. Schools were not looking very good. Morale was not up. Where years ago, that changed. Dr. Anderson came in with her feet on the ground. She was running.
And normally, I'd actually be doing work through this speaker on the phone, but I will just not do that.
Good morning. Very well.
So math testing is going well.
When I taught, I either wore a suit or a dress every day, and I wore tennis shoes every day. The tennis shoes are really that boots to the ground, or in my case, sneakers to the ground feel. You have to be comfortable in your own skin and knowing that you come dressed for the work at hand. And for me, the work at hand is not work that I can do in heels.
So that was Tiffany Anderson. You saw that on the clip that you just viewed. And Tiffany is a dynamic leader. She was at the time the superintendent of the Jennings School District in Jennings, Missouri. She's currently the superintendent in the Topeka, Kansas School District. And although we could talk for 45 minutes just on Tiffany's leadership and the things that she's done to disrupt poverty, what we want to focus you in on is the last statement that she made, and that you see that on your screen. What does it mean to you to be comfortable in your own skin and come to work dressed for the work? Now, normally, if we were doing a live workshop with you, we'd actually take some time to ask you to think about that question. And throughout this webinar, we've got other guiding questions like this that if you were using this with a faculty, you might stop and have some conversation about that. The reason that this is an important question is because one of the things that we learned from the teachers we interviewed for the Disrupting Poverty book was that one of the keys to their own success was who they were as people and what they believed about kids who lived in poverty, about teaching, about their role as a teacher. When we looked at our data, it reminded us of that point of the importance of who we are. It reminded us of something that Parker Palmer says in The Courage to Teach. he talks about our attempts in the United States to improve schools. And he says, usually when we're talking about improving schools, the most commonly asked question is what? What should we teach? As I think about it, you think about standards. So what should we teach our new standards? And he says, then when the conversation goes a bit deeper, we ask the how questions. So then we get into pedagogy, you know, how, what are the strategies? What are the approaches we should use? He says occasionally, if the conversation about improvement goes a bit deeper, we'll ask the why question. Why is this important to teach? Or even why do we teach? Why do we lead? Why are we educators? But he says the question we seldom, if ever, ask is the who question. And interestingly, the who question is the question that was one of the most important things in our study. Who these teachers were mattered greatly to their success. One of the things we talk about in both of our books is the importance of mental maps. This is closely connected to the idea of who you are as a leader, who your teachers are as teachers. So what is a mental map? It is the images, the assumptions, the stories that we as human beings carry around in our mind that shape our behavior and our attitude about everything. They come from pretty much everything we've lived, and we all have a mental map. They're unconsciously or tacitly held. We're usually not aware of them unless we, are thrust into some kind of experience that pulls them to the surface. And they can limit our ability to change. And the reason that they can limit our ability to change is because as human beings, we tend to take in only information that confirms what we already believe. So what we have found in the schools that we studied, we found that collective inquiry was a very important part of how they became successful, because it would help them challenge their own mental maps about kids who live in poverty and their families. And on a personal level, being a reflective practitioner, many of the teachers, all the teachers we interviewed in one way or the other, were practicing reflective practitioners. Now, as important as it is to talk about the who question and even the why question, today we're going to focus primarily on the what and how question, because in the end, if we look at Michael Fullan's research, we know that all the moral imperative in the world, all of the knowing who we are and why we do this very important work, doesn't get us anywhere unless we also know how to do the work and what to do and how to do it. And so that's really what we will be focused on today, these five elements that were taken from the first study of high-performing, high-poverty schools, and then we looked at them at the classroom level.
So the first of those, building caring relationships. Relationships are something that we know, probably all of you have uttered the phrase, it's all about relationships. All of you have staff in your buildings that probably a number of them that are exceptional in terms of relationships with kids and families and other adults. It's a huge building block. We know that. But we also found that relationships in these schools and from these teachers we studied go quite a bit deeper. And we're going to share another video with you now that exemplifies how one California school that we studied in our video series, what relationships mean to them. You'll be able to watch a little bit of their actions and their kids and their behaviors.
It's a kaleidoscope of different backgrounds, different experiences, different socioeconomic levels that come together around a common mission when they cross our threshold each morning.
The mission to become a high-performing school, despite being a high-poverty school, needed a starting point. For Summit Charter Academy, that starting point was safety. Make school the safest place in the world to learn and grow. A place built on trusting relationships and cooperation. In fact, cooperation is the first word in the acronym CARES, a school-wide character education program that launched everything.
I think CARES is really important because it teaches kids at a young age, from kindergarten to fifth grade, that you could help anyone if you use these elements: cooperation, assertion, responsibility, empathy and self-control.
So at the beginning, we made CARES the common language of the school. So the entire staff, the students, the families were all using that language to describe positive behaviors. We just really celebrated examples of students and staff using their CARES. In addition to our motto, College for Certain, each of our classrooms is named for our college. So, for instance, one of our kinder classes is UC Berkeley, and they really do believe they're attending UC Berkeley. So they're hearing that language early on. You're going to college. Because we know if we wait till high school, it's too late.
Yellow jackets. Answering the school-wide call to foster healthy, safe, caring learning environments, teachers took steps to build a sense of community in their classrooms. Today, every room at Summit is a safe place.
On the count of three, say, oh yeah. One, two, three, oh yeah.
Where students are valued and supported and know that they belong.
One of the amazing things about Summit is that we loop with our students. And so they enter my class in kindergarten and they stay with me for first grade. And so it really allows us to cement that bond because now we have known each other for 2 years.
One, two, three, all eyes on me.
One, two, eyes on you.
How does a person's perspective influence their opinion?
Thank you, Natalie. You can have a seat. All right, pioneers. We're going to continue with our lesson on the Revolutionary War.
The fourth graders in this classroom community know it's okay to express themselves and take risks.
Feathered and sometimes killed. That's your evidence.
Tootsie roll.
Maria Rodriguez-Drain explicitly teaches the skills of academic discourse and collaborative conversation.
All right, so I'm going to pull a stick, and you're going to stand and deliver what your partner shared, state number four. All right, says G.
Me and my partner Brianna said that the loyalists might have not wanted to fight in the war. It was because they thought King George would fight for them.
We know that if classrooms have a community, then students are going to be much more likely to learn. And if they make a mistake, they have a community that they want to come back to.
Do we agree? Do we disagree?
So I think a lot of the work with safe and healthy environment is giving students a voice and ownership in creating that for themselves.
Okay. And then Brianna?
I agree with my peers. And I'd like to add on, if King George texts someone so far away, like, that's not fair.
Brianna's right. If you're so far away, and then they're putting demands on you, and then you don't have a say, remember taxation without
representation,
right? No one's there to speak for your rights.
Something that I like about being a student at Summit is that we focus on college. Also, one thing that I really like is when you're, like, really stressed out about something. They always have, like, a time where you could get all your wiggles out. If you're upset, they help you or they tell you to take a break. My favorite part about Summit is that everybody knows each other, and then our teachers are there. We know that somebody cares about us, and somebody's right there to help us with whatever we need help on. They don't teach everybody the same way. They teach everybody a certain way, like different strategies, and which one works best for your brain.
So if we take a minute to just dissect that, from a leadership perspective, Summit did at least four things to build relationships. And so these were sort of some school-wide things that might be important to consider. They developed the CARES. That was a homegrown kind of character ed sort of thing. They did looping. That was a structure that they used. Teachers had professional development in community building, morning meetings, those sorts of things. And some teachers had professional development in collaborative conversations. So you can see there's a lot of ways that they focused on and prioritized relationships. We know that relationships are paramount. They are paramount to everything else that a successful teacher does. They are particularly important for kids who live in poverty and underachieve, because we know they can increase students' efforts and engagement. They can also promote resiliency. And we know from a lot of folks' work, but specifically John Hattie's work, that the relationship between the student and the teacher is important for improving academic achievement. In the classroom, we just want to mention four kinds of roles that we heard teachers tell us about were important as we interviewed them for the Disrupting Poverty book. They talked about being a role model. As an example, one of the high school teachers talked about he was a role model for a work ethic, and the kind of work ethic he expected of kids was the kind of work ethic that he demonstrated for his students. And he said when he was willing to meet them where they were, have difficult conversations with them, let them know that he was there for them, that they were willing to do the same for him, that they would put in the effort. Another kind of relationship that teachers talked about was being a mentor or a hope bearer. Anna herself grew up in poverty. These are all pseudonyms, but Anna grew up in poverty, and she told us, you got to give kids hope. You need to help them see their future. When we asked her a little bit more about how she did that, she said, ask them about their aspirations, know what their dreams are, suggest things to them based on their interests and strengths, and always tell them that you believe in them. David talked about being an intervener and the importance of being an intervener, and talked about some of the ways that he intervened with students who had had challenges in their lives, and how that had helped those students come out of sometimes belief that they were the cause of those problems and be able to focus on academic achievement. And finally, Lizzie, high school chemistry teacher, who talked about team building, that she spends the first 2 weeks with team building activities in which she joins her students, and that team building got kids that didn't normally work with each other to work with each other, and it was the basis upon which then she did cooperative learning later in her classroom. I think the most hopeful thing about this first disruption, this building caring relationships, is that the research consistently shows ours and others that it's the ordinariness of what teachers do that matters, that the sorts of things that the teachers talked about that we have more about in the book are within the capacity of most teachers to implement. Again, a guiding question that you might use if you were to use this webinar with faculty: what evidence do you currently have that educators are explicitly cultivating relationships with students in your school and in your district?
So now we're going to move to the second area, and that's holding high expectations and providing needed support. Again, we know you all are aware and probably completely engaged in the practice of trying to get to high expectations for everyone. It's easy to talk about. It's not easy to do. What we found in some of the schools that we studied was that, and this is an area that both schools as well as principals shared with us, that and teachers, that this was an absolute non-negotiable. You had to get to high expectations and believe that every kid could do the work and could succeed. If that wasn't there, there were a lot of problems, and I'm sure all of you are well aware of those. So they did several things. How do you get your teachers to a place of high expectations? And some of the things we learned were obviously connecting them with research and what we know about high expectations. A second area is what do we know from practice about high expectations? What goes on in these schools? And then third, how do we self-inspect? How do we take on our own expectations? This is a tool that we won't again do today, but that we'd ask you to consider if you're going to work with your staff on expectations. And usually what we do when we use this is just use this page and have folks list out individually what it looks like when teachers have low expectations. What are those practices? What's going on? What's going on in a classroom? List a series of bullets. Next to that, then, what does it look like when they have high expectations? So we kind of have folks do their own self-analysis from their perspective. Then we move to this slide, which is somewhere back in our book. I don't think we have the page number here, but it's an assessment of research. And if you notice at the bottom, this research goes way back to the 70s. What basically it reflects is we've been studying expectations for 50 years, five decades. And we share this then with participants to look down at what the research has indicated over these decades teachers look like that have low expectations. What practices, what behaviors? That's the left column. The right column, teachers who hold high expectations. So obviously, this would be a place you could pick out a few of these and talk about. I won't do that today, but there'll be things, aspects of these practices and behaviors that probably ring a bell for a lot of you. So part of it, again, is getting folks to self-inspect and look at their own mindsets, their own maps as far as expectations of kids. And if they're doing a lot of the things on the left side, or you're seeing a lot of those happening, it becomes a departure point for conversation.
So as important as teacher expectations are, and they are very important, you know, two points that we make in the book that I think are, we don't have them on a slide, but they're worth mentioning. One is expectations, as it turns out, high expectations, actually research has demonstrated, are most important for kids of color and kids who live in poverty, our most vulnerable kids. And the other thing we know is that high expectations actually, again, like relationships, can build resiliency in kids. So that's an important piece. A third piece is that kids' own expectations of themselves are important. And we have a resource we just want to mention. We've worked with a school in Virginia Beach, Virginia, Parkway Elementary, a school that's done some incredible work. They are fully accredited, and one of their keys to success was a book study they did on the power of our words. You see the front of that book. The reason we're mentioning it here is because it was powerful in helping that staff help kids rethink their own expectations of themselves through the ways that teachers talk to those students.
Parkway is one of those high-performing, high-poverty schools, and I don't think we mentioned earlier, we're currently completing over the next 5 months a second edition of that first book, and Parkway will be one of about a dozen schools, new schools, that we're highlighting. So before too long, you'll get a chance to learn a little bit more about Parkway. You can also go in and check out their work through their website.
Again, two guiding questions for this section. What evidence do you have that educators hold high expectations of students? How do your classrooms look? Do they look like that list we just shared with you? And then how are educators increasing students' expectations of themselves?
The third area that we're going to speak about today is making a commitment to equity. And this is something we found pervasive in these schools, as well as from the teachers that we interviewed and studied. They understood the difference between an equitable classroom and where practice and resources were divided equally. We created what we refer to as an equity litmus test. These are areas, some of the areas within equity that actually in classrooms don't cost anything to address and take on. But there are three critical areas of homework, grading, and classroom assessments that if you don't have an equitable environment and aren't making a commitment to serving kids equitably, you'll suffer the consequences, and we see that in far too many schools.
These three, the reason that we selected these three is often teachers have the most autonomy. These are under their control, and they can make a huge impact in terms of their commitment to equity in their classroom by looking at what they do with these three practices. As we think about homework, and we're just going to mention a bit about homework, we're not going to talk about too much about or any about grading or classroom-based assessment today, but some of the equity-based challenges that to think about in terms of what are you doing with homework in your school is, you know, parental availability for support, a space to do that homework, limited access to resources and supplies, and limited access to computers or internet. One study that we reference in the book talked about 50% of the students that they interviewed reported that they couldn't complete their homework due to lack of access to a computer or internet, and 42% of those kids had a lowered grade because of that limited access. So it begs the question of equity.
Again, Hattie's review of decades of studies that have looked at homework, we have a difficult time, and we all know that Hattie's effect size of 0.40 is that median point where above a 0.40 effect size is something that has far more promise than what's below. It doesn't mean these don't work, but there are a lot of problems and challenges. And if we had more time with you, we'd share stories and examples, and you have plenty of your own as well in terms of this arena of homework that we'd urge you to take on. Anywhere we speak, anywhere we go, we ask, what's your policy? Are you sure you have homework handled in an equitable manner, whether at the district level or at the school level? And we ask for examples, and virtually everywhere we go, what we hear are lots of the problems and challenges, that this is an area that really probably needs a lot of attention. We saw attention, great attention being given to this in these high-performing, high-poverty schools.
So some of the things that you might think about, and we won't go through these, but there's a checkpoint for equitable homework here that we have on this slide. These are some things to think about. At the base, it's not about whether homework is bad or good. Certainly the research shows that it's an iffy proposition. Sometimes it may work, sometimes it may not. Really, if you dig deeper into Hattie's work, it shows that at the elementary level, it's pretty much ineffective for improving academic achievement. But if you decide that homework is important for whatever reason, this checkpoints for equitable homework might be helpful for you. And again, the guiding question here, overall, how are teachers committing to equity in the classrooms in your schools? How are you supporting them to do that? And specifically, what are they doing with those three practices, homework, grading, and classroom-based assessment?
And for leaders, if we can go back to that a minute, for leaders like yourselves, it's important to consider, how do you know? How do we know, other than testimony from classrooms and teachers? What is your evidence to see in a classroom within its homework, its grading, or its assessment practices that there is equity occurring? And that's a critical part of that self-inspection as well that we found happening in these schools and among these teachers that said we had to work hard, continually work hard to make sure we were getting to equity.
This is our second to the last disruption we're going to talk about. And this one is a tough one, taking professional accountability for learning. As Bill and I looked at the data that we'd gathered from interviewing teachers, we realized, and as we reflected back on our first study, we realized that one of the most important things that we saw about these teachers and those schools that we had studied is the almost absence of blame. You just didn't hear teachers and administrators blaming kids and families, which is not always the case in a low-performing school. And then when we stood back just a little bit further from that and asked the question, what is it that made them different? What we found was these teachers took professional accountability for learning. They went back to the drawing board when kids didn't learn rather than blaming kids and families. But the reason they were able to do that is because they had a high degree of self-efficacy. They genuinely knew that they could impact the degree to which a student learned. And they knew that they were the one that had the power to do that, which made a huge difference in terms of they had no reason to blame kids and families. You know, one of the questions you might be wondering is if teachers don't have high expectations for kids and they don't believe in themselves, then how will they ever change their mental map? What we know is that behavior changes come before beliefs. And what we mean by that is one of the most important things you as a principal, and most of you are principals or administrators or teacher leaders, coaches, that kind of thing, is to build self-efficacy in those that you serve. So what is self-efficacy? It's the belief or conviction that a teacher can influence how well a student learns, even those that may be difficult or unmotivated. From a researcher's point of view, which should impact, hopefully impacts you as a practitioner, when we look at what we know about self-efficacy, we know that it impacts, that when you see a teacher or teachers that have a high level of self-efficacy, they are more persistent and resilient. They're more willing to use innovative approaches, more willing to work longer with struggling students, have greater enthusiasm for teaching. They're less negative, less critical of students, and they improve student achievement. When I look at a list like that, I think, ding, 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 we really ought to be attending to this. And that is, in fact, what successful principals from high poverty, high performing schools told us they did. One of the things that we want you to notice about this, again, like high expectations, you see the citations. We went back to the seminal work. We've known that self-efficacy is extremely important, and we've known it for 30-some, almost 40 years. So growing your teachers is a very important thing. In the book, we won't have time today to talk about what do you grow your teachers in, but we do try to give some guidance in the book about, in this chapter on taking accountability, professional accountability for learning, some a guidance in what you might build self-efficacy in. The other thing that we provide at the end, we have a ton of teacher voice in this and think it's a very important thing as we think about how do you help teachers rethink maybe their mental maps about kids who live in poverty. And so each chapter ends with what we call tips from teachers. And this particular chapter, which is a hard thing to talk about, are your teachers blaming kids and families, or are they taking accountability for learning? What we find is the teachers themselves said, these are our tips. Focus on what you can control. Be open to and willing to be critiqued. Find an accountability partner, that you have somebody that holds you accountable. Let students know you won't give up on them. Consider yourself on the same team as your kids and be willing to take risks. That's how they take professional accountability for learning.
Teacher efficacy and collective teacher efficacy, which is obviously teachers feeling strongly and positive about their own practice and working with others that feel the same way. When those come together, it's little surprise that Hattie's found in his latest work, as he's elevated collective teacher efficacy to the top of his effects, 1.57. It's kind of off the charts. What strikes us about this work is that this is precisely what we found in these high-performing, high-poverty schools. The teachers work together. They believed in each other. They picked each other up. They helped each other. And they also took a powerful approach to their own teaching, their own instruction, always seeking to get better and always seeking to be more effective with their kids. We're going to share a little clip we grabbed off YouTube of John Hattie talking about collective teacher efficacy. As it's something that just resounded so heavily from everything we've studied, this is kind of what we saw as well. So let's listen to John.
The new number one invisible learning is teachers' collective efficacy. And on the one hand, that's exciting because it confirms the story. On the other hand, it's a bit of an unfortunate title. It kind of implies that having efficacy, having confidence, having all the teachers in the school believing they can make a difference. It's actually more than that. Now, to have a meta-analysis, you have to have lots of studies. This is not a new idea. This has been around a long time. But it's just that Rachel Ells was the one that pulled it all together to show what its combined effect was. And the message I want to get across, it is teachers working together to have appropriately high, challenging expectations of what a year's growth for a year's input looks like, fit with the evidence of impact. And that's what sustains it. It isn't just growth mindset. It's not just rah-rah thinking. It's not just, oh, we can make a difference. But it's that combined belief that it's us that causes learning. It's not the students. It's not the students from particular social backgrounds. It's not all the barriers out there. Because when you fundamentally believe you can make the difference, and then you feed it with the evidence you are, that is dramatically powerful.
So you can see that little clip really reinforces a lot of what we started way at the beginning with Michael Fullan's work that says all the moral purpose in the world isn't going to get you there if you don't also know what to do and how to do it. And that's what John Hattie's talking about. How do you change somebody's mental map? You build their skills and you change their behavior and their belief system changes.
So the question at the bottom of this, again, is a good one for schools. It's a good one for leaders to contemplate in your schools. How are you supporting professional accountability for students? Are the teachers owning it? Do we own it as a school? Are we a system of independent operators, or are we working as a system to help each other. All of those aspects come into play as far as elements that we saw happening that took schools from being often good schools to great schools, from being effective to highly effective to being high performing when most would think with their populations they couldn't be.
So just a word before we open for questions about this last disruption, taking courageous action. You know, when we interviewed the teachers, a lot of them didn't think of themselves as courageous, and they often thought of their students as courageous. But what we have tried to sprinkle throughout the book, the Disrupting Poverty book, were examples of the ways that these teachers were courageous. And often it was their willingness to step out in front and challenge things that they knew that were going on that were harmful to kids. And doing that in front, you know, with their peers, which often takes a lot of courage, or challenging the status quo, things that just hadn't been thought about. You know, one of the things we have in our first study, in our first book, that people have told us is very helpful is the idea that there are lots of things that schools have to stop doing if they are going to actually disrupt poverty. And so if we had more time, we would talk more about that. There are several things that literally you have to stop doing. In the end, one of the most important points that we'd like to make about courage and is that if we all, first of all, let me just say that it takes humility and vulnerability to actually face our own mental maps. That no matter how much, you know, Bill and I work with schools or study poverty, no matter our own backgrounds, we still have to be willing to check our biases, to uncover our implicit bias. And that takes courage. The other thing that takes courage and is that sometimes it's hard to face how much power we actually do have, because if we actually face how much power we have, we'd have to do something about it. And that's really where we land, is that these were teachers who just did what they could. And as inadequate as that might sound, it wasn't inadequate at all.
So we reflect on and have throughout our work, the work of Ron Edmonds. A lot of you have seen probably another quote that speaks to the effect of how many effective schools would you have to see to be convinced of the educability of all kids. Edmonds, in his work in the 80s and 90s, and you know Ron Edmonds, all of you studied Ron Edmonds' work as far as him being one of the architects of the correlates of effective schools. He'd seen enough schools 30, 40 years ago to know that this work could be done. We use another quote from that, actually, that same article in ASCD, Ed Leadership article, about 40 years ago, and I'll read this one to you. When we can, whenever we choose, successfully teach all children whose schooling is of importance to us, we already know more than we need to do that. Whether or not we do it must finally depend on how we feel about the fact we haven't so far. We talk about we urge folks to contemplate these words and unpack these words a little bit. One of the things we find happening in schools is when we think about this, we haven't so far, what does our data tell us about where we are? An area we didn't go into in this session today that we encourage all of our schools to and folks that are intent on improvement to take a look at are what we refer to as their brutal facts. This the term brutal facts originated from the book Good to Great, Jim Collins' work of about 20 years ago when he studied organizations and their journeys moving from being good to great. And he determined that these organizations, and it wasn't just all businesses, it was social organizations as well, these organizations focused on, as a part of the process, their brutal facts. What are our brutal facts? We would urge you to take that on. Do you have 30% of your kids in your school that are not reading proficiently? That's a brutal fact. What do your math scores tell you? What does your behavior tell you? What does your attendance tell you? If you don't have kids where you want them and think you should have them, those are the areas to take apart and kind of unpack. And so when Edmonds talks about how we feel about the fact we haven't so far, that's the work. That's the work. And every one of the schools and every one of the teachers we studied as well that were either a part of high-performing, high-poverty schools or just darn good teachers in schools, every one of them talked to us about having to look at their data and having to check out where they were and set a course on how do we get better and to have a sense of urgency in doing that work. In other words, not a 5-year plan, not a 7-year plan, a this month plan, a next month plan. And those kinds of efforts and that sense of urgency really rang true throughout all these settings we studied. You've got to want to do it. And honestly, you have to then go after it and do it. And a lot of it is in your power to do. A couple of the videos that we showed today, that there's a page in what you can download as far as the links to get to those, either through the YouTube or through the series where a couple of these others came from that you can access by the link here. And I think what we'd like to do is at this point open things up for questions and ask you if you have any, please shoot them in. We have one that has come in that we can start with, and that was a question of I'll just read it here. What are some strategies that you'd suggest for a school leader to create
accountability for student learning?
Accountability for student, it's cut off by the edge of the screen. Accountability for student learning system.
So, one of the things that I think is important about that piece, and if we kind of blend what we know from both studies, I said it very quickly, but the number one role that a lot of these principals that we interviewed when we did the first study talked about in one way or the other was that they felt their number one job was to grow their teachers. How they grew their teachers was varied across from school to school. And it's not probably anything that other schools aren't doing. It's just the prioritization that those principals placed on professionally developing their teaching staff. And so it was things like high-quality PLCs. It was things like learning labs that were something like the Japanese lesson study. It was knowing what each teacher's strengths and weaknesses were and doing some individualization. There were a lot of different ways that they built their teacher self-efficacy in order for those teachers to move away from blame and take professional accountability for learning. The other piece that I kind of skipped over quickly but is in the book is the what do teachers need to know? What are the best practices? And in the book we talk about, ten specific best practices, things like explicitly teaching creative and critical thinking. How are you specifically doing that? The research around project-based or place-based learning, those kinds of things. So those are how you create an accountability for learning system. You build your teacher self-efficacy, you build collective efficacy, and typically you do it through routes that you're probably using. It just means prioritizing it and making it job one.
Another area of leader strategy, if you will, that we saw happening, we could share an example from a district we were in just a couple of weeks ago, that has spent a good bit of time and effort developing both leaders in schools as well as in their self-efficacy and capacity, as well as highly functioning leadership teams within the buildings. There's a question for you to take back and ponder, to hold that mirror up. Do we have a highly functioning leadership team, or is it a leadership team that is simply representative of the different areas of the building? Are these the movers and the shakers? Are these the folks that clearly are anywhere from aspiring leaders to some of the best teachers in our building that can help us lead this work and build this capacity.
And are those leadership teams talking about pedagogy? Are they talking about teaching? Or is it just management and operation of the building? In the most powerful schools, the schools that have been successful, the leadership team is talking about teaching.
So use those words, highly functional. Have we got one? How do we grow it? How do we support it? How do we rely on it? Another question just came in. How can we get teachers recruited in low poverty schools, knowing that it might be difficult conditions other than there might be difficult conditions other than pedagogical challenges?
Recruited in high poverty schools, I'm assuming. You know, one of the things that this is a tough one, where schools start is that in the beginning, when they start their high poverty and maybe not high performing, the way they attract talent is they start changing their own story, and they begin celebrating the small wins and communicating those small wins out to everyone. I'm thinking of an example of a school district, you know, near us where that was actually recruitment and retention of teachers was a very big problem because there were other places teachers could work, had a lower percentage of poverty and greater, better pay. And the way that school district took that on was actually changing the district story. What did people think about that district? And it was slow, but what it eventually did was attract people. People started asking, what's going on in this district? What's happening? And so once you start getting that snowball going of all the quick wins, all of the small victories, celebrating them and communicating them to your community, to the professional world, that's one of the things that we've seen be a powerful way to recruit, is to start to change the story. If you can get people in teams, recruiting in teams, that's an important piece. And then once you get them there, supporting them so that they stay. You know, people will stay if they like the people they work for and the people they work with, and they believe the work is good work.
And seeing good practice is very much a part of this as well. One of the schools that will be in our new book that we're studying right now has a commitment that once a year, every adult in their building has the opportunity to travel and visit and observe, spend a day in a high-performing, high-poverty school. We share this everywhere we go. Do that. Find these schools. They're all over the country. You can locate them and go spend a day. See what's going on in these schools. It certainly could help you. Kathleen and I have been honored to be with you today. We had a two-hour leadership meeting canceled this morning as a holiday gift to us. And while we didn't cancel this webinar for all of you, we'll let you out 2 minutes early today.
Yeah, so, well, we'd like to thank you from NAESB. Thank you, Dr. Parrott and Dr. Budge, for all this information that you shared. Can you tell us your email address or Twitter account, just in case people may have some further questions?
Those are on the first page of the slide deck for both of us, both our Twitter accounts and our email, and we'd urge anyone to get in touch with us if we can help them with any specific questions and help them get better.
Thank you so much.
Well, on behalf of NAESP, our Executive Director, Dr. Earl Franks, our Associate Executive Director of Professional Learning, Gail Morgan, Honor Phoebe and myself, Aaron Lurie, we thank you for attending this webinar Wednesday, and thank Dr. Parrott and Dr. Budge for being with us today. Thank you so much, and catch us out next month in our next installment of Webinar Wednesdays. Thank you so much. Have a great day.